Welcome to Going to Seed podcast with Holly and Joseph. We're happy to be here today. We have William DeMille, who is going to be with us. William is a farmer and educator. He studied horticulture and agronomy at Northwest Missouri University. He holds two certificates in aquaponic engineering and production from Cornell University of New York and from Grohaus Aquaponics, and also graduated from Dr. Elaine Soil Food Web School and Healing Mountain Massage School. William is the director of Georgic Development for Monticello College in Utah. William is a farm consultant and runs a school in Northern Nevada, teaching the principles of permaculture, biodynamics, silvopasture, holistic management, and Georgics. William owns and operates a soil testing laboratory. We're excited to have William with us today. We've got some good questions. We've asked him to talk to us today about staying ahead of the weeds, Landrace style, and no-till gardening.
Welcome, William. I wanted to share a little bit of remembrance about that I have with William. And I met William at a conference in Cedar City, Utah for farmers, and William was involved in something called Georgics, which to me, I'd never heard the name before. And it was strange and unusual, and I didn't understand anything about it. But what I did understand was the idea of self-sufficiency and taking care of yourself and not having a middleman between you and your food and between you and your community. And so that was really... So I feel like William's just a kindred soul to me, because that's how I've lived my whole life and never knew there was anybody else that lived the same way. And then he invited me to see his beautiful greenhouse, like a wallapini dug down into the ground. And so welcome, William.
Hey, thank you, Joseph and Holly. It's great to be with you today. I'm excited to share things the way we do it here in Nevada.
Sweet. So, Holly, do you have a personal remembrance you'd like to share about William?
I first heard about William just online doing my chip gardening and Landrace gardening, and I saw him come up. I watched some of his things. I'm interested in building a wallapini. So then he had some cool stuff. So then I just did searches on his name and found as much as I could. And I mentioned it to Joseph, like, have you heard of this guy? And he's like, oh, yes, he's my friend. So we made an appointment, and Joseph went, and we went out to, and that's when I first met William, as Joseph introduced me. And since then, we've had opportunities to do podcasts. And I went out earlier this year and we did some herbal medicine fun stuff. So, yeah.
Thank you.
And we've shared seeds. Oh, by the way, did you get your fava beans planted?
Yeah, they're up. They're about 6 inches high. They're doing really good.
Beautiful.
And all the cabbage seeds you gave me, they're coming up. They're doing good. They're ready to transplant right now.
So do you have anything you'd like to add to the introductions that we skipped over?
No, not necessarily. I'm running my school here. I've got 10 students this year. Most of them are college-aged people. It is for adults. And we're just teaching them how to grow food, how to do personal development and self-discovery so that they can accomplish their goals in life.
That is so beautiful. Tell us a little bit more about your school program.
Okay, well, it goes for 17 weeks, so it's about 4 months long. We live at 5,800 feet, so we have a pretty short growing season. The old timers say you can not grow a garden here because you can get a frost every month of the year. So for my students who are here, I kind of feel like if they can learn to garden here, then they'll be successful almost anywhere else that they try to have a garden. And so it's kind of good. It's kind of like the pilots who learn to fly a small aircraft in Alaska. If you learn with all the harsh conditions of Alaska, you're going to be a pretty safe pilot anywhere else. So that's kind of right. The philosophy that we do here with our school.
Beautiful. Tell us how Georgia plays into your school.
Okay, yeah, so let's just get the definition out of the way first, because it's an ancient word, but it's not a word that's used nowadays very often. So Georgic means farming. Geo is earth, and then auric is work, and it has origins in both Latin and Greek languages. And the Roman poet Virgil, he's the one who came up with the word. He kind of coined the word Georgic, meaning to work the earth or to be a farmer. And when he wrote his Georgic poems, he was talking about returning to the land. And his main point, and anybody can go read the Georgics, they're in the libraries. I mean, you know, if you went to college and studied English, you've heard of Virgil and all his poetry. But if you go and read his Georgic poems, the real message of that is stop being dependent on the modern way of getting food and go out there and work yourself to grow your own food, and you will be a better citizen than if you don't. And the good citizen is what makes up a civilization. And I mean, you know, and it's funny because he wrote it 2,000 years ago, but it's still applicable today. So apparently human nature never changes, at least it hasn't when you start reading ancient history and ancient literature. So Georgics is the idea of building the best civilization we can, where people have a food supply, people have clothing, people have housing, we have clean water. We basically have opportunities to do things. Young people have opportunities for education. You know, old people are taken care of. Just what we would want in a civilization. Do you want an orchestra? Do you want a library? Do we want some nice things that build our world? And most people would say, well, yeah, those, I mean, that is what we want in our civilization. And the ancient literature of the Georgic tradition tells us that we need to be close to the earth, creating the basics, the food supply, the water supply, the housing, and the clothing. And the further away we are removed from those basics, then that impacts our freedom, because we're dependent on somebody else to provide those basics for us. So, you know, we see a lot of that in the writings of the American founding. We see it in the writings of the Anglo-Saxons. We see it in the history of Switzerland. We even see it before Virgil wrote. You know, you go back 700 years to the Greeks, and Hesiod writes Works and Days. You can go to the library and look that one up. And that's the first writing about the Georgic tradition that I'm aware of. Is Hesiod's Works and Days, and the idea of just working hard to provide for something for yourself and your family. Because if you're waiting for somebody else to provide it for you, then you might get hungry and you may starve to death. So this is the message of the Georgic tradition. We have modern writers too. We've got Victor Davis Hanson. We've got Louis L'Amour. There's a lot of modern writers who are writing about this self-sufficiency and a resilient person that is built when a person goes out and works on the land. So that's Georgics in a very quick nutshell.
I'm just enamored with that. Thank you, William.
You bet.
I love the part about being a good citizen. And I do believe if everyone grew some food, there'd be a lot less complaining and trouble in the streets in our country, because you do respect nature more and one another. It's a journey to learn how to do it and do it well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and that, you know, there was a quote from one of the ancients, and I forget which text it's in, but they said that the good citizen is the true harvest of the soil, not the food. The good citizen is the true harvest of the soil, not the food. So that, I mean, and you think about that and it's like, wow. So somehow when a person is involved with Mother Nature, doing this process that we call farming, and not modern industrial farming. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about you're actually out there, you're seeing the seed, the flower. You have an intimate relationship with the earth. You're seeing how it's all connected. You know, the permaculture world and the biodynamic world, the silvopasture world, they're a lot closer to what's really happening in Mother Nature and closer to the idea of Georgics than a lot of our big industrial farming systems today. So when I say farming, I'm probably talking more about home gardening, although you can do this on large acreages because it's more of a mindset. Let me just share one more quote and then we'll move on. But Hesiod in Works and Days, he said, build barns. It won't be summer forever. So I love that one. You know, it's the idea of work while you can, make hay while the sun shines, all of those types of things.
Right. Wow. That's good.
Thank you, William. So tell us about how you came to this sort of understanding about, I mean, how did you get to where you are today with your understanding and your gardening? And just give us a little background about how you got to where you are.
Okay, yeah. So I'm 50 years old. That kind of helps to put things into context a little bit. When I grew up, I grew up in a little town called Hurricane, Utah. It's turned into a city at this point, but when I was a kid, it was really small. And my dad, grandpa, had a little farm there, and they worked together. And so I was the third generation on that piece of ground. And we grew all kinds of stuff. And we grew, a good 85 to 95% of our food. We had milk cows. We had milk goats. We had a pretty nice flock of sheep. It was, you know, certain times of the year, we would have 100 sheep. And we had fruit trees. We had plums, cherries, apples, pears, grapevines, and then other things like currants and all kinds of other berries. So we just had a lot of things, and we had huge vegetable gardens. We'd grow all different kinds of corn, lots of different types of Native American corn. They did well there. We were there on the border of the Mojave Desert, and they did really good. A lot of the more ancient type of squashes and beans. My dad he really loved the Native American people. And so he had got seed from his friends, from different groups of the natives. And we've just incorporated a lot of this into our garden. But we grew a lot of our food. So I was very interested in gardening. I was in the garden my entire childhood. And we would raise just these beautiful foods. And then once in a while, a weird thing would happen. Like somebody would pass out a peach that they had got from a store. And it just didn't taste right, man. There was something wrong with that. It was wretched. And yeah, but I didn't know that that was normal. I thought that, I thought there was, oh, this peach is terrible. It's not even edible. But other people are just eating them because other people were educated by the grocery store, which is a terrible education. So, my interest in this was just bred into me. And then when I was older, when I got to be about 12 years old, I told my dad, I said, I want to do the garden next year. I just want to see if I can do it. And you don't help me. Nobody helped me. I just want to do the whole garden. But see, this wasn't a hobby. This is a big deal. You know, we're talking about like a 7,000-8,000 square foot garden. And it was the majority of our vegetables. And my mom would do a lot of canning to feed us through the winter and all that. And we ate lots of fresh things. Of course, in Hurricane, we had, I don't even know how many days our growing season was, but just to put it in context, there were some years when we could get 8 cuttings of alfalfa. So our winter's about 2 months long, and sometimes 4 months. But so we had an incredibly long growing season, which was beautiful. Sometimes people in the community would plant their peas in the fall. And then they'd be coming up in late January. So we had this incredible, beautiful, long growing season. And at 12 years old, I thought, I want to take over this garden. I just kind of wanted to prove it to myself, but I hadn't thought of that. But looking back, as a 50-year-old looking back, I think at 12, I wanted to have some self-validation. I wanted to prove to myself that I could do it. But at a 12-year-old, I would have just said, oh, I'm excited, and let me take over, Dad. So my dad didn't want the garden to just fall apart because it's our food supply. So he said, okay, you can take over, but you be with me every day when I'm doing stuff in this garden. And it's like January and we're just getting started. He's starting transplants and stuff, just planting seeds when we had this conversation. So he said, get going with me here. You are with me every day through this whole process. And if you're with me the whole time, then I can teach you every single detail I do. And then next year you can take over. And I don't know what was in his mind at that point, but you know, I did. I stuck with him and I was all the way there. And the next year, about Christmas time, some seed catalogs started coming in the mail. And he said, here's your seed catalogs. Go through them. Make you a seed order. And I mean, man, I knew what he was talking about. And I'm like, yeah, that was like the coming of age. That was the thing. It was so great. And I did the garden that next year. So I was 12 going on 13 that year when I took over the garden. And, you know, my dad was still there with me that year too, but he took two steps back and watched me. And when he saw little things happening, I remember some tomato plants had damping off. And he said, you're giving these too much water. You need to get a fan on them. You need to water them from the bottom. And, you know, I mean, he had experience because he had been doing this all his life. And so little things like that, he would step in to make sure we actually had food. And we had a big, beautiful garden that year, and it was pretty great. I remember later in the year, he had ordered some Lemon Boy tomatoes, and they ripen a beautiful yellow tomato. Well, I'm out there checking the garden every day, and I didn't know that a tomato would turn yellow. I'd never seen such a thing at 12 years old. So I'm waiting for them to turn red, and they're not ripening. Well, there were the three first tomatoes just rotted on the ground because they needed to be picked a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. And finally, when he saw it, I think he thought, oh, I've there's some holes in this kid's education here, which is pretty funny. So, you know, as far as the history and the Georgics goes and teaching and running these classes that I'm doing, I was probably 17, 18, and I really got interested in the history of all this stuff because as I'd keep going through catalogs every year, all the seed catalogs, by the way, my dad would get like 20 to 40 seed catalogs. If there was a seed company, my dad tried to get a seed catalog from them, and I would just read them all. I was kind of a crazy kid. My wife thinks I'm somewhat on the autism spectrum because I focus so much on certain things and then I'm really out of balance in other parts of my life. But yeah, as a kid, I was just going through all these seed catalogs and they would talk about where the heritage of seeds were from. You know, this one was developed by Dr. James Bagot in Oregon State University, and other things would talk about these heirlooms that came from far away. And so it started getting me interested about, you know, where things came from and who developed what. And that got me more interested in the history of just everything, you know, the human race and all of the earth. So as my education went on over the years, I was pretty excited about the way people lived. And, you know, in a grassland, it can be harder to grow things than like along a temperate zone along a coastal region of the ocean, as far as, you know, like certain vegetables and things like Italy. It's a pretty nice place to grow a lot of vegetables, a really nice Mediterranean climate. I mean, compared to the center of the United States, we have a beautiful grassland, but you have long, cold, harsh winters. And then we got the mountain valleys, you know, crazy places like where I live and where Joseph lives, you know. So we have all these pretty awesome places where things grow harsh and it's hard to grow. And so it was always fun to find the plants that would grow in those areas. But what I've really done is I just read a lot. I've got a big library. I read a lot of books. And I got to the point where I'm thinking, you know what? There's a lot of people who don't know some of the gems that I've been blessed to understand. I want to pass this on to the next generation and help people to understand this. So that's a little bit about me.
Sweet.
Well, that leads you into, you know, why you're so self-reliant, because you didn't like the grocery store education. And
that's
so,
right.
So how are you putting that forward into community gardening, where you share with others so that they will acquire the taste for good food and the desire to grow it? How do you really approach that?
Yeah, you know, I think from probably the philosophical side, I approach it from human health. I really feel like people in this country, in our United States, we are going to bed with full bellies, but we're starving to death. So many of the problems that we're dealing with nowadays with human health, I just really feel like it just goes back to the fact that we're just not eating good food. And even a lot of people I know personally who tend to choose the right things to eat, they're still not getting the nutrition because they're eating out of the grocery store. And the grocery store isn't really there to create maximum nutrition. They're there to sell stuff. It's all about the profit margins. And I don't know that it's bad to have a profit margin. I mean, I have a business. I need to have a profit margin too. And I think that helps to have a good society if businesses are profitable. So I'm not against that. But why don't we have the highest quality product? That's what bugs me. You know, I've got friends who've graduated from the horticulture departments across the country, and these college departments are teaching people how to have long shelf life. And they say, well, don't worry about flavor, because you got to sell this. It has to sit on the shelf for a long time till somebody finally buys it. Boy, I hate that. I really don't like that at all. Because, I mean, flavor equals nutrition to me. So I'm approaching my teaching from human health. And there's enough sick people out there that people seem to be listening to me. Because, I mean, it hits close to home, you know? I'm like, wow, if I eat higher quality food, will I actually have higher quality health, you know? And it seems like sometimes that's not true and there's not a correlation, but man, I really believe there is. I see it in myself. Like a year and a half ago, I stopped eating sugar, just normal sugar. And I started reading ingredients. If there was any kind of sugar, corn syrup, just any of that stuff in it, that's the high glycemic sugars, I just quit eating it. Which pretty much means I stopped eating from the grocery store, because almost everything has sugar in it. So that was, I mean, I already knew that, but it was a lot more eye-opening. And then in the last 4 months, I just started eating mostly everything that we produce here on the ranch. So we've got grass-fed beef, we've got grass-fed eggs, grass-fed chicken, grass-fed dairy, because we've got milk cows here. We've got all kinds of fruits and vegetables that we're growing here. We grow them outside and in the greenhouse. But anyway, in this journey, I mean, I've lost 60 pounds in the last year and a half, and I wasn't even trying to lose any weight. I just got mad because everybody's sick. I wasn't sick. I mean, I was a lot huskier, but I didn't feel fat. And so, but I mean, I was like 240 and now I'm like at 175. My ideal weight should probably be like 170 to 180. So I'm kind of hit my ideal weight as far as the charts go. But I didn't really have any health problems. But I thought, you know what? I'm 50 years old. I probably should eat the best food ever. And I can, because I've been growing it. So it's stupid of me not to. So I just kind of buckled down and thought, okay, I'm making this commitment. So when I drive somewhere, I'm taking stuff from my greenhouse, and I'm not stopping at the hamburger shop anymore. And I feel better too. I really do. So to answer your question, Holly, I'm approaching educating my community just with human health, and it's working for me. So I think it'll work for other people too.
Well, and just the fact that you're growing tasty food, I really believe that flavor and nutrition are highly correlated. All right, so let's get into the nitty-gritty. Tell us about weeds in a garden and how do you handle the weeds?
Okay, so I wrote a book a year ago or 2 years, I don't know when it was, but and
Can you take a moment to tell us the title of the book?
oh sure, it's called Worry-Free Eating. So Worry-Free Eating, a Mindful Food Production Book. And I just thought we ought to be thinking about this because are weeds as bad as as people think they are? So there's this whole section of the book. Well, maybe it's just a few pages, but I'm talking about weeds. I'm like, weeds are not the enemy that we think they are in our modern world. Weeds are our allies. Weeds are our friends. I mean, you can eat most of them, and they're more nutritious than what you're getting at the grocery store, but I don't tell people that until they've I already have some education. That's not the first thing you tell people, or they won't listen to anything else you say. But I really like weeds. People come into my greenhouse and they're walking around and they're like, man, there's weeds everywhere. Let me tell you why I have weeds. I learned this from Dr. Christine Jones. She's probably the world leading plant pathologist. She's from Australia. And she taught me that when you have four plant families growing together, close enough together that the roots are touching, then that turns on what we call secondary metabolites in plants. And then your plants have more pest resistance, more disease resistance. They will oftentimes grow better. Sometimes the food tastes better. You get more flavors. You can get richer colors. So there's interesting things that happen with secondary metabolites compared to if you only have the primary metabolites turned on. So if you can just let a few weeds grow, as long as they're not crowding out your major food crop or shading them, those are my two things. I will manage the weeds in such a way that they're not crowding or shading, and then I just kind of let them be there. And a lot of weeds will crowd and shade, so I don't let those ones be there. But what happens is if you're trying to grow a vegetable garden, if you may be growing like three things for whatever reason, I think you should be growing 50 things, but for some people you're growing three things, it can be impossible to have four plant families if you're growing tomatoes, peppers, and potatoes, and those are your three things, because they're all the same family. So if you let a few weeds grow here and there, then you can easily get your four plant families, and it helps those other crops to grow much better. So, I mean, weeds are not the boogeyman. Weeds are not the great evil. We just have to know how to work with them and manage them. Weeds are also an ecological indicator of what succession your soil is in. So, do you have a desert soil? Do you have a forest soil? Do you have a grassland soil? And and that's helpful depending on the crops you want to grow. If you're trying to grow trees or raspberries, you would want a forest type soil. If you're trying to grow cabbages and broccoli and cauliflower, you want more of a desert soil. If you're growing pretty much anything else, not really, but most of the food crops, grow in more of a grassland type soil. So knowing which weeds are just coming up without you doing a thing, if you learn which weeds grow in which kind of an ecological succession soil, then that can help you know which plants you're going to be able to grow a lot easier without doing a lot of work. So, I mean, weeds are great, man. We just have to become ecologically literate enough so that when we walk out there in Mother Nature, we can read Mother Nature like a book. And when that happens, and it can happen quick. So my 4 month class here, it's my students come and they're ecologically illiterate because everybody is today pretty much, and especially if they're coming to my class. And so in by about 3 months in, these guys got it because it's not that hard. We just have to know the right things. So the last month of class, we do a lot of nature walks, and we're going out there, and I'm just asking lots of questions. And my students are saying, oh, here's this weed. That means that there's this and this. We go for an eighth of a mile, and we're in a different place where there's quaking aspen trees growing, and they're identifying other types of plants there. And they're like, oh, yeah, well, this is must be a lot of fungus in the soil because we're seeing these certain plants growing here. I'm like, yeah, you guys got it. So, yeah, anyway, it's pretty fun, you know. Weeds are not the bad guys. Weeds are good. I love weeds. You just have to manage them to your advantage.
Thank you.
I love that. I have a nice little patch of morning glory bindweed, and for a long time I would just fret over it, but once I just decided I'm only pulling it when it's going to crowd out or choke out something. But every time I pull it, there's worms come up. There's all this good stuff. I know that my soil's good and I grow really good crops. So I do go through every once in a while and remove some of it. But
yeah,
I read an article that bindweed, it sends little messages down the line. If there's an attack of bugs up here, it sends it down, and the little roots that touch it, all the other plants benefit from, I guess it might be an electrical pulse or something. I don't know exactly how that works, but they help each other stay strong and healthy, I think.
Yeah, it's true. You know, morning glory, it can certainly be a problem. I was in Blandon, Utah, just, what was it, 2 weeks ago, I guess, and I went to several people's yards just to help out the community a little bit. And there was one lady, and she had morning glory everywhere. Of course, every yard I went to had a morning glory problem, but everybody's pulling it out. And I asked one guy, I said, how long have you been fighting this morning glory? He said, for 40 years. I said, you've lived right here for 40 years. He goes, yeah, I've lived here all my life. And I said, well, that's interesting. So how do you get rid of it? And he said, well, and he was tilling it, you know. Well, I just have to till this area like twice a year, I have to till it up. And I'm like, well, and so I explained to him, I said, well, do you know what the function is of early succession weeds? And he just looked at me with a blank stare. He didn't know what the term early succession meant at all. So I just kept going and tried to educate a little bit. And I just said, the function of an early succession weed is to cover the ground. And once your ground is completely covered, and so the ground's not disturbed anymore, the early succession weeds tend to go away, and then you start getting grassland-type plants. A lot of the more beautiful wildflowers and grasses and that. And then later on, you'll start getting shrubs and trees growing. And he's, you know, that made his eye twitch. But because most people, we think, you know, we've got to kill all these weeds. We've got to be working hard. We've got to be getting them out. And what's the number one tool that modern people use to get rid of weeds? Well, it's tillage. But every time we till, we are creating a desert because now there's just bare ground. And anytime there's bare ground, you have created the perfect condition for the weeds that most people hate the worst to take off and grow. And so it's a, you know, it's a losing battle. So I never tell people to till to get rid of weeds. I always say just cover the ground, get 6 inches of wood chips out there, you know, cover it with cardboard. That'll smother things out. Cover it with compost, but always get like 6 to 8 inches. And I, people don't know how to run a tape measure. I don't mean to be rude here. I just want to be descriptive. People's yards, they come to my boot camps. You know, I have 3-day boot camps I teach. People come, and then occasionally I end up in one of their yards a year or two later. And I say, how much detritosphere have you got on the surface? And that's just how much mulch. So, and they say, oh yeah, man, we put on 6-8 inches, and we go over there and we look down and we can see bare soil between a couple of wood chips that are scattered around. And there, and of course there's morning glory and there's thistles and there's like the hedge bindweed, and you've got the red root amaranth and lamb's quarters. All the early succession weeds are coming up. They said, yeah, it didn't work very good the way you're teaching it. And I said, well, you got to have 8 inches on here, and then you have to maintain it with an inch of good compost every year. And I'm like, yeah, boy, that's what I did. And I said, well, look down. You can see the ground. They're like, Well, yeah, that's because I had weeds, and so I had to till it. Never till it again, man. Sell that rotor tiller so you're not tempted to till it. So, you know, old habits are hard to break.
William, you're scaring me because I've just acquired a new field this week, and it's growing perennial grasses and dandelions. And I want to turn it into a garden. And I'm like, oh no, the only method I know is tilling.
Yeah, right. And you're more than a backyard gardener, you know, because you've got larger plots of ground for sure. So, you know, we have to remember context. Context is so important. And I'm not sure how much land you're farming right now, Joseph, but I know in the past you've had some pretty large market gardens. And there's nothing wrong with tillage as long as you're managing the land properly. So tillage isn't the worst thing ever. But if your soil isn't functioning and your soil is requiring, you know, a lot of inputs to get the plants to grow, then you've killed the soil, you know. And remember, soil isn't dirt. When I'm talking about soil, I'm talking about the microbes in the soil. You know, one tillage pass, Dr. Johnson, Dr. Ingham, others have shown that one tillage pass through a field can kill 50% of your beneficial fungus, which is interesting because two passes doesn't kill 100%, but 20 passes certainly will kill it all. You know, so you got to figure out what you're doing. If you're a backyard gardener with a 15-foot by 50-foot garden, you can grow a lot of food for your family on that. And there's really no reason to till it. And you can have such a beautiful functioning soil that you're going to be turning on secondary metabolites. You're going to have the healthiest food possible. You know, and it's going to take you 3 to 5 years to get there. But if you're bigger than that, if you're farming an acre or two or five, you probably are going to use some tillage. Although, if you're doing a couple of hundred acres and you've got a tractor and you're raising grains, let's say you're raising corn or soybeans or pumpkins or whatever, you don't need to be tilling anymore because they've got the tools out there nowadays. You can get you a roller crimper and you can just be growing your cover crops, plant them in the fall, roll or crimp them down in the springtime, and just plant right in them. The day you roll or crimp it down, you plant right behind it. You have a beautiful mulch on the soil, and then your plants come up through it. So, I mean, the world of this whole regenerative world is pretty neat. You know, Dr. Alan Williams, I was talking to him last summer, and he said that we're up to 38 million acres that are no longer tilling, using pesticides or using herbicides or nematicides or fungicides. And that is good news for our world. 38 million acres. And that does not include a home gardener. It's no small market gardener going to farmers markets, because Alan Williams doesn't even know who those guys are. We're talking about big industrial agriculture. We're talking cornfields across the Midwest. And so that is fantastic news. And that's what we need. Now realize when you do the math, 38 million acres is still less than 3% of farm ground. So we have a long ways to go, but this is catching on. And the reason it's catching on is because it's profitable for farmers. They're making a lot more money. Right now, in today's world, fertilizer is the number one biggest expense for the row crop farmers across the country. And they are eliminating all of their fertilizer within 3 to 5 years of switching over to doing this more organic way of doing it. And they're not certifying organic because they don't have a benefit of the certification, but they're just doing it because it makes economic sense. So, you know, on the bigger scale, these are working. No, I can't do that here because I have an 80-day growing season. So if I grow a cover crop, I need to terminate it like the middle of June, maybe even the third week of June. Well, I needed to get my corn planted the first week of June, or I can't really get corn. So that's where the land racing comes in. Awesome. We need to be land racing varieties of corn that will mature quicker. So I've been working with the Painted Mountain corn that was developed in Montana. In fact, I think I got my original seeds from you, Joseph, of that variety. That may not be true, but if my memory's right, I think I got a package of that from you, and I started saving my own seed every year. So what we're doing is we're saving the ears that are maturing the quickest on those. So, yeah.
Painted Mountain is a beautiful corn, and I'm sure I offered seed to you whether or not you took it. Holly's growing that this year.
I planted some a little bit ago. It's starting to pop its head up. We'll see.
Nice.
It's kind of early for, I've never planted this early. I planted my fava beans on the 29th of February, and they're in full blossom now.
Nice. Yeah.
And so I'm really pushing the edges of my growing season, trying to learn what crops I can grow earlier.
But yeah.
How does the condition of the soil affect when things freeze and stuff? I can see a difference because I do chips. And I can see a difference in my garden and how it survives pests and weather much better than I ever had experienced before. What are you seeing in that?
Yeah, so you know, our weather here, so I've been here 4 years now in where I am right now, Northern Nevada, and every year has been so different with the weather that it's hard for me to make any kind of comparisons. But what I do know is the soils that are new soils, meaning I haven't worked with them yet because I plant gardens in areas that's just desert, and the new soils that have no microbes in them yet, they are not performing nearly as well as the gardens where I've been getting it covered and then inoculating with a compost extract. And those ones are growing, you know, it's germinating quicker. The plants are growing better. You know, we have better harvests from those. So, and I do a lot of soil work for sure. And I realize that in the land race world that if I'm doing that, then the plants are adapting to that. But that's kind of my thing. That's my baby is the soil. So, I mean, I like making compost. I like looking at the creatures with my microscope. I like getting the entire soil food web in there so that I know that the nitrogen cycle is working and everything else. And so that's just the way I'm approaching it. And I'm okay with that, you know, and it's great to be trading seeds with people who aren't. And that's just, I think it just makes the genetic pool better to have some people who are doing it with no, you know, just desert ground and you can get those seeds to adapt to like really poor conditions. But that's like 10% of what I'm doing. I'm trying to feed people. So I'm trying to grow the best yields I can. I do like big crops of stuff. So anyway, that's kind of where I'm coming from.
So when you say you're feeding the soil with microbes, does your biodynamic training enter into that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I really love biodynamics, man. I don't understand it. And for people trained in science, they're just like, I don't even know. In fact, I can tell you a personal story just real quick. So Ray Archuleta, he's probably the top soil scientist in the country as far as the university crowd goes, because there's different top scientists with different crowds of people. So if we're going to talk about reductionist science, I would say that Ray Archuleta is one of the top. And he was showing all of his, he had a slide that he showed with all of the soil samples that he took over his 30 plus year career of being in charge of half the United States. And so he had tens of thousands of soil samples. So there's tens of thousands of little points all over this graph. You couldn't even read the graph. It was just covered with dots, but he knew what it meant and he was explaining it. And he said, these are all the soil samples that I took in my entire career before I retired. And And there was this one that was way up high. And he said, we have an outlier up here, and so we won't worry about that. And then he was just he went back and he was talking about the trend of soils. And what he was saying was really neat, that all soils have all the nutrients that plants need. We just need enough microbes in the soil to make them to get the nutrients plant available. And then my friend Jared Sorensen, I live here on his ranch here. He was in right there and he raised his hand, and I'm glad he did. He raised his hand and said, Ray, tell us about the outlier. What are they doing? Because it was way up above all the others on the graph. And Ray kind of, he was just like, oh boy. You know, he was kind of like, oh, I don't want to get into it. But he said, okay, well, I can tell you what it is, but I can't explain it because we just don't understand how it works at all. But it's called biodynamics. We did soil tests on these guys' farms, and they were the top soil we've ever seen. And we have no idea how they did it. And then somebody else said something, and you know, at that people kind of joked around. And it's funny because a lot of times the jokes are like, well, they just say their prayers at night. And that's kind of true, because that's what the biodynamic people will often tell you. When you're awake, you work as if it depends on you all day long. And then when you go to bed at night, you pray and invite the angels to come work all night while you're asleep. I mean, that's in the biodynamic literature. And so it's interesting. It's just a fun world. You know, you're making compost, you're putting the cow manure in lactating cow horns. You're making all the composting preps with all the awesome herbs. You got valerian and equisetum and all the others. And so the thing that makes my eye twitch is, for every biodynamic person out there who's really doing it, you have a whole new way of doing it. It's such a personal thing. You go to the biodynamic conferences, and boy, you'll see a lot of people arguing because they're like, oh, that's not how you're supposed to make that preparation. Well, I just don't see there's room for argument, because it's personal. And if you've got good herbs and you're using them and you have faith, you're believing that it's going to work, it tends to work. These biodynamic farms, I mean, they've got the best soils. They have fantastic crops. Their yields are pretty good. And they have frost resistance in fruit trees when their neighbors' trees are freezing out. So it's almost like magic. If you're a religious person, then it's like religion and faith. If you're a scientific person, you just don't understand it. But it's really, really fun. Anyway, so biodynamics, it certainly comes into what I'm doing. I teach all this stuff to my students, and we practice it here. We do all the permaculture stuff too. And I don't see that any of these people are like in opposition to each other. But if you go to the permaculture places, they'll say, oh, we're way better than biodynamic. And when you go to the biodynamic conference, they say, oh, we're way better than the permaculture. So there's kind of a rift in a lot of these communities. I've even heard that from some of the silvopasture people saying, oh, we're so much more advanced than everybody else. I think in the community of growing things and being involved in Mother Nature, I think it would be a really good idea to quit saying we're better than other people and embrace the good that everybody has. That's kind of what I try to teach my students.
You use the vocabulary word that I don't understand. Could you talk about silvopasture for a bit?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So silvopasture, that's when you're incorporating trees into your system. So, you know, there's the seven layers of foliage or plants that is often taught within the realm of permaculture. So, you know, you got your roots, your ground covers, your vines, shrubs, trees. Anyway, there's the seven layers, your overstory, understory. And the silvopasture people, I feel like they kind of took that to the next level. And they're saying, if we're going to have a truly regenerative world where we're healing a lot of the environmental problems, then we need a massive amount of trees. The Diné people, which are often called the Navajo, they talk about having 16 trees per acre is kind of a good number. And different cultures have different numbers of trees that you should have per acre. I kind of think it depends on your climate and where you are, you know, your ecoregion. But if you're having, let's say you have some cattle or deer or elk or sheep or whatever, but there's animals around, you need to be incorporating the animals into that system to get the healthiest ecosystem. So silvopasture is just a way of integrating livestock with trees and pasture, fruit trees, anything that you'd have in a food forest that the permaculture people teach. And then you're using like any life you can get. If it's like, I mean, there's some people that are down on livestock in the world. And I kind of don't understand that, because you go into Mother Nature and there's all kinds of animals out there. So as a steward of the land, I kind of think if I'm going to have the healthiest ecosystem, I need to be incorporating as many animals as I can, but obviously in a way that makes things thrive the most. So if I have maximum plant growth on an acre of land, that's because I have incorporated animals and they've come through and they've done what they do. You have that animal impact through the year. So silvopasture is simply incorporating trees. So you wouldn't want a farm that is just a pasture. I mean, you could, and there's a lot of farms like that, but you will grow more grass and more everything if you have trees in the right proportion for that ecoregion. So that's a nutshell of silvopasture.
Thank you. And the one other thing from your bio that I'd like to talk about is holistic management.
Yeah, holistic management. That term comes from probably the greatest ecologist alive today, although he's old, so he's going to be passing on soon, but that would be Alan Savory. And he grew up in Africa, so Zimbabwe, although back in the day when he was young, I think the country was called Rhodesia. But that's where he grew up. He loved wildlife. He loved wildlife, and he wanted to preserve the wildlife in his region. And he was taught from the scientists and the universities that livestock were the biggest thing against, you know, the wildlife, and it was hurting the ecosystem. But through his work over the years, he found that livestock are one of the very best tools to restore the desertified land into a beautiful grassland and beautiful forests. Managed properly, livestock are one of the greatest things. And in fact, we're doing that here in Nevada. So we have a pretty good sized ranch here, and we just got 2,000 cattle in here this last week. They came on semi-trucks, we unloaded them, and we are managing them exactly the way that Alan Savory teaches. So we're moving them across the sagebrush country, and as they poop, when those cow pies are on the ground, if you don't bring the cows back for 1 to 3 years, grass will grow where those cow pies are. But if the cattle are just walking around all the time and they break up those cow pies, then the little seeds of grass can't grow if you break up the cow pie. So you have to know your environment. You have to know how to manage the environment. So yeah, holistic management, that's holistic management in a nutshell.
Thank you.
Wow, that's awesome. I can remember as a girl, you know, go out in the pasture and we'd kick a cowpile over. There was all kinds of stuff growing besides the bugs and things. But yeah, it always was a lot of taller, darker green grass right around a full dried up cowpile. I never really thought about it, but that's kind of, I'm becoming more observant, and I love that about gardening. You know, I'm applying my research skills from all my family history work to my garden, and it's very exciting, and I love it. So is there anything that you'd like to share with us that you haven't yet?
You know, man, I've been talking a lot. I probably told you everything I know. I think just in closing, probably I just really want to evangelize what I'm doing with my school, you know, for anybody who hears this. This is my third year. The first year I had two students here. I've been wanting to do a school since I was 19 years old, thinking I could teach gardening. And here I am 50 years old, and I just got started a couple of years ago. And last year I had four students. This year I have 10 students. And all of my students from the previous years, with, you know, the four and the two, they've all said, oh, can we come back this year? Can we spend some time? I know you have your other class, but we'll just pitch a tent. Can we spend time there? So when 100% of your people want to come back, it's a pretty good indicator that I've done something right. So I'm pleased with that. And so I just thought, you know what? I'm going to create a situation where they can come back. So instead of having a one-year program, I just announced a week ago that I have a four-year program where we actually help people to start an entrepreneurial business with whatever their gifts and talents align to, you know, whether it's in gardening or research, or, I mean, we're certainly involved in agriculture. So, you know, anybody wanting to do anything, but there are so many things that this world needs. There's so many problems in the world. And you know what the solution is? It's the solution, not the problem, because people focus on the problems. I'm so tired of that because it doesn't help. But, and so that's what I tell my kids here, and my students, I call them kids because they're young. But when they come here, I'm like, what is your gift? What is your talent? What is your passion for life? Go do those things. And I give them permission, because so many times people are really excited about something. And then there's people who say, oh, you can't do that because you can't make any money. Man, who cares if you can't make money? If you're solving a societal problem, you will earn enough money to pay your bills and live your life. It's not about being a multi-billionaire. Let's have more people living the purpose for which they were born, and the world will become a better place for everybody to live. So, I mean, learn some basics, you know, and that's what we're teaching people. We're helping people to learn a little bit about themselves, to have some self-discovery, some self-validation, and come here and heal. I mean, we've been going for 1 week now. We just started last week, so it'll be 4 months through this summer. We've already had a couple of classes where there's been tears, and people are just like, wow, this is really good. I've never felt this way before. And it's not set up to make people cry. It's not set up to make people have these deep emotions. It's just that we're talking about real things, real opportunities. And I, when I went to college, I never really had a class where I felt like I had a real opportunity. It always seemed like there was some kind of agenda happening. And I mean, I learned great stuff in college, don't get me wrong, but I created something different. I want people to be able to come here and to have an experience, to know that they are worth something and their gifts and talents are needed in this world. So that's all I have to share.
Wow, that's awesome. Reminds me of Fukuoka. And if you guys listening haven't heard of Fukuoka, Masanobu Fukuoka, look him up. It's inspiring to all of us. Give us an idea, or tell our listeners how they can contact you and get a hold of you, or online, in person, whatever, however you want people to contact you.
Yeah, so all my contact info is on my website. So it's georgic.com, G-E-O-R-G-I-C. revolution.com.
That with the show notes, so people can, as they listen to it, they can find you. We really appreciate and have enjoyed this hour with you today, William. Look forward to the next visit, whether you come up north. Well, is it north or east?
East.
You come east. It was north when you were in Hurricane. Anyway, yeah. Come east, or we come west again. Look forward to the next opportunity we have to work on a project together. Thank you.
Thank you, William. Thank you, I'm so super much. Excited to go home and introduce all of this stuff into my garden and see how it works out.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. This has been really fun.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
If you want your vegetables to have a genuine zest for life, then Joseph Lofthouse's book, Landrace Gardening, is for you. Here's what readers are saying. A short, inspiring, informative read that blew my mind at least once per chapter. Everything is far more productive and delicious than ever before. The best book I've read on gardening in ages. Get your copy of Landrace Gardening now, and start growing locally adapted varieties.